Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Go ask Alice about all the music she's inspired. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Our series, Music by the Book, continues with a look at a novel ostensibly for children that has become a creative goldmine for musicians. And later, centuries-old folk songs and murder ballads come alive in the music of Among the Oak and Ash, the duo will play live in our studio. But to begin, few children's stories have the staying power of Alice in Wonderland. More than 140 years after she first appeared in a Lewis Carroll book, Alice popped up twice last week, first in a new Disney movie from Tim Burton, set to come out next year, and again in a postmodern adaptation of the Alice books, staged by maximum security prisoners in Italy. Today, as part of our Monday series, Music by the Book, two guests join us for a look at how Alice has inspired music. David Del Tredici has composed numerous works based on the Alice stories, and in fact, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Music with this work called In Memory of a Summer Day. David, welcome back.
Good to be here, John. Thank you.
And joining us on the line is Professor Mara Gubar. She is the director of the Children's Literature Program at the University of Pittsburgh and author of the book Artful Dodgers, Reconceiving the Golden Age of Children's Literature. Mara, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there are plenty of classic children's books out there, Mara. What's so special about Alice?
Well, it's a good question because it's one of the most widely quoted books in the Western world, next to the Bible and Shakespeare, and it's been adapted into a million different formats, stage, film, ballet, opera, teapots, biscuit tins. So why is it so endlessly adaptable? Is that the question?
Yeah. Well, yeah. What's the enduring appeal across all these media and across, you know, decades and a century and a half?
Yeah, I think part of it is that the books themselves are so open to a variety of interests so that whatever you're interested in, you can sort of look to Alice and find something, you know, in them. I mean, they've been read as political satire, attacks on religion, treatises on math, philosophy, linguistics, right? Whatever you're interested in, psychoanalytic, you know, people have read them that way. Literary critics have read them in endless ways. And I think it's because they're so sort of episodic in their structure. They have themselves a kind of improvisational feel to them, so that, you know, they feel like things that people could latch on to and do different things with. Does that make sense?
So it's sort of like Lewis Carroll was making it up as he goes along. You get that kind of, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I think it's a little more than that. So if you think about the books, one thing that really appeals to people about them is that they're packed with sort of puns and parodies and playing with language, and they're about the idea of interpretation. And if you think of that scene where Alice eats the cake that says, eat me,
right.
I always think it's like Carroll's books are saying, use me, because he himself is playing with nursery rhymes and, you know, different kinds of mathematical ideas and linguistic ideas and literary ideas, you know. And so the books themselves are very open to having other people want to sort of adapt and reinterpret and reinvent them, because Carroll himself has so much fun rewriting other people's poems, you know, taking their popular songs and making plays on them. You know, he himself is so playful.
And David, as a composer yourself, I mean, you know, at this point, we don't get the old parodies of 19th century poems or hymn tunes and stuff. What was it that attracted you in the 1970s to this?
Well, I had an obsession with James Joyce before Lewis Carroll, as you mentioned, and that wore its way down. Then someone said, you should read Alice in Wonderland. I read it, and I said, it's too slight. Then I found this book called The Annotated Alice by Martin Gardner, where he has, for each little Carroll ditty, a Victorian original. So that seemed a unique thing to set the ditty and the real Carroll poem side by side. Sometimes they'd be contrasting, like Be Gentle would be the original Victorian thing, and he would write this poem, Be Rough. So it would be very perfect setup for somehow contrasting texts and contrasting music. So that got me started. You know, sex runs the world. and it also ran Lewis Carroll. And what makes these Carroll books different from the other Carroll books is the passion for the little girls he liked, particularly Alice, which he poured into these puns and sort of squeezed it around the corner and made them not quite recognizable, but still wet with interest and passion. The mixture of those sexy things and the Victorian non-sexy is somehow unique. And then to call it a children's story is very brash.
Well, now that's I did use the word ostensibly, Mara, in introducing the. I mean, who was his intended audience? Was it really 11-year-old Alice, or was he looking beyond her?
Well, you know, the book was written, you know, it came out of a story, an actual story he told little Alice when they were boating on a river near Oxford to her and her two sisters. So it was a children's story originally in the sense that he told it to actual children, and he took her as the main character, and her cat, she actually had a cat named Dinah, right? And so he sort of told this story about them, and all the little girls and the people, there was another guy in the boat with them, became characters in the story. And then she asked him to write it down for her. She said, you know, please, Mr. Dodgson, will you write down that wonderful story you told me? So he did. He wrote his own version and he illustrated it himself. And then he sort of got the idea that he might publish it for real as a children's book. And so so it started off as an actual story for an actual group of children. But he did intend for it to be read by children, although, of course, it's also been read by adults.
All right, and the kind of the sexy overtones that David's talking about leads to the sort of the lurid backstory, which we can get to in a little while. But first, let's hear some of the music that that Alice has inspired over the years. I mean, what does it say about the current audience? That's a question that perhaps we can pose to our audience. Soundcheck listeners, leave us a comment at WNYC.org on the Soundcheck page. Let us know your favorite music inspired by Alice.
Tell 'em a hookah, smoking caterpillar, has given you the call, Alice, when she was just small.
Perhaps the best-known piece of music inspired by Alice's adventures in Wonderland, White Rabbit, from Jefferson Airplane, 1967. Just a few years later, Donovan took the poem Jabberwocky from Through the Looking Glass and set it to music.
Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the jump-jump bird and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the manxome foe he
saw. Donovan singing about the frumious bandersnatch and the Jabberwock and all the rest. And in 2001... the band One Ring Zero, Brooklyn-based group, was commissioned to do a full-length dance concert based on Alice.
Speak roughly to your little boy and beat him when he sneezes. He only does it to annoy, because he knows it teases.
Pig and Pepper is a little clip from Alice, a full-length dance music piece by the band One Ring Zero. We're talking about the musical inspiration of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland with Mara Gubarsh from the University of Pittsburgh and with composer David Del Tredici, whose piece In Memory of a Summer Day, which we began with, actually won the Pulitzer Prize. But David, it was just one of... How many pieces did you end up writing under the spell of Lewis Carroll?
Well, the spell lasted about 20 years. I don't know how many, but I like the book because each book is a little complete short story. So that in the beginning, I just took the poem, then little by little, I added the texts which surrounded the poem. So finally, by the time I got to Final Alice, I was really writing a kind of opera for the concert stage.
Now, Final Alice, that's kind of the first of the big orchestral Alice pieces.
Well, it was the first that became known. I had written a number before that, but that had it was recorded and was done by Chicago Symphony, so it was the most grasped.
And it was controversial for a really bizarre, and only in the world of contemporary classical music could a piece be controversial for being pretty. This was a real sea change for you personally, and it turned out to be a landmark moment in contemporary orchestral music as well.
Well, I was probably the first one to go back to tonality. They call me a neo-tonalist. We all thought that music would continually get more dissonant, starting with Schoenberg and going on through the completely atonal. Then, for some reason, inspired again by Lewis Carroll and the stories, by then atonal language just didn't fit these charming, witty, whimsy Victorian ballads. So I, without realizing what I was doing, just reached into my grab bag of tonal means and wrote tonally. And then it was a shock when it actually was done, and it was very polarizing. Before Final Alice, I was a respected composer. Afterwards, I was either loved or hated.
And which do you prefer, to be respected or hated?
Well, in the context, hated.
So, Final Alice, this piece is from 1976,
yes,
isn't it?
For the bicentennial.
Was that in your mind that it was for the bicentennial?
No, that was the commission. Every major orchestra got to commission somebody, and Schulte in Chicago commissioned me.
All right, so Sir George Schulte in Chicago Symphony Orchestra asked David Del Tredici for a piece, and this is the piece they got. A little bit of music from David Del Tredici, the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, my guest here in the studio. Final Alice is one of a number of pieces that he wrote over a 20-year period, inspired by Lewis Carroll's tales of Alice in Wonderland. We're also joined on the phone by Mara Gubar from the University of Pittsburgh, English professor, author of the book Artful Dodgers. And Soundcheck listeners, we want to know what your favorite Alice-inspired music is, what you think keeps people, musicians, playwrights, visual artists, after all these years, coming back to Lewis Carroll's stories. You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
We think of psychedelia as beginning in the 60s, by which we mean the 1960s. Lewis Carroll's books suggest the 1860s might have been more accurate. Take this example from Through the Looking Glass. "I see nobody on the road," said Alice. "I only wish I had such eyes," the king remarked in a fretful tone. "To be able to see nobody, and at that distance, too."
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Well, here is a quote or a comment from Stephen here in New York on the Soundcheck page. He asks, "Any research about drugs or mind-altering experiences that might have been had by Dodson because of the other reality he wrote about, Mara?"
Yes, this is my undergraduate's favorite question about Alice in Wonderland. They always ask about this because they pick up on the hookah that the caterpillar smokes.
Right, the caterpillar smokes a hookah. There's mushroom eating involved.
Yes, we have no evidence that I know of that he ever experimented with drugs. But, of course, this is the historical past we're talking about, you know. So, I mean, he may not have wanted to write that in his diary, right, if he had. But I know of no evidence that he actually did. He was, however, really interested in spiritualism, which was a big craze in the 1880s and 90s, right, alternative reality in terms
theosophy
of getting...
Theosophy and stuff like that?
You got it, exactly. So I tend to think of that as the more likely possibility because he was a pretty fussy, proper, sort of prim, straight-laced kind of a fellow. He was a deacon in the church. You know, it's hard for me to imagine him experimenting with drugs, but who knows?
David? I have an alternative.
You might.
For Lewis Carroll, little girls were his drug of choice.
What about, you know, the hookahs and the mushrooms and this kind of, there is a kind of proto-psychedelic effect in a lot of these.
His passion was little girls. You know, that we know. In fact, he destroyed many pictures before he died. Every single little girl's mother dragged her away from him after a certain point.
Well, that's something that we want to come back to, because there's a whole story of the story behind the books and, of course, the man behind Lewis Carroll, who was Charles Dodson, a mathematician and a deacon and an artist as well. So we'll pick up on that thread in a moment. And a little bit of music here from Tom Petty as Ellen from New London, Connecticut writes on the soundcheck page, Tom Petty, Don't Come Around Here No More video. Amazing. The video starts with Tom Petty sort of adopting the role of the hookah-smoking caterpillar. In a moment, the curious backstory of Alice in Wonderland and its author, from some illicit photographs to a notable Beatles reference. And then, another trip back in time, with Appalachian folk tunes remade by the duo called Among the Oak and the Ash. They'll play live in our studio later on Soundcheck. As we This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our look at music inspired by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, the children's books by Lewis Carroll, part of our Monday series Music by the Book. And yes, even the rock gods of Aerosmith tackled the Alice story. You're hearing their 2001 song Sunshine right now. We're joined again by the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Del Tredici, who created numerous works inspired by the Alice story. And on the phone, Mara Gubar from the University of Pittsburgh, English professor and director of the Children's Literature Program. And Mara, let me bring up the unsavory topic that David has already raised twice here. So let's follow through on this. Charles Dodson, mathematician and a deacon. You called him a very sort of straight-laced, you know, Victorian guy.
Mm-hmm.
What about, you know, all the photographs of nude and semi-nude girls that he was known to have taken and stuff like that?
Well, I think, again, this is a point there's always going to be controversy on, partly because Dodson's heirs destroyed his diaries and many of his letters, and as we said, many of the photos were also destroyed. But I think it's important to, so we'll never really know one way or the other, for example, if he was in love with Alice particularly, because those are the diaries that have been destroyed. But we do know that he wasn't so much deviating from a cultural norm in having this attitude toward children. So, in other words, there was a sort of a widespread tendency to sort of idolize and eroticize children in Victorian culture, to sort of set up the child as a kind of icon of attractiveness, to have a very passionate attitude. He definitely took it quite far, right, in terms of showering children with games and letters and puzzles he created for them and taking them to the theater and inviting them to stay with him and taking these pictures. So this is why I say there's a controversy, because there's certainly all of that. On the other hand, some scholars say, Well, lots of other people who we do not think of, you know, as having any kind of pedophilic tendencies were also doing this, mm-hmm. including women. So there's a female photographer named Julia Margaret Cameron who took equally, if not more, erotic photographs of little girls and little boys. And, you know, no one is getting all upset about that simply because she was a woman, you know, and many people were doing this. Christmas cards often featured naked children during this era. So I'm not denying what's been said already. I'm just saying there's sort of two sides to this controversy. Those who say, no, this is really disturbing and he was completely obsessed, you know, only with children. And sort of some more recent scholars who say things like, well, yes, he was, but so were a lot of people. And in fact, he didn't go as far as some others who mm-hmm. actually proposed marriage and ended up marrying 12 and 13 and 14-year-old girls.
Jackie here in New York leaves this comment on the Soundcheck page. There's nothing sexual about the character Alice. She's a child in a fantasy land created to enchant the mind of children. Your guest speaker's projection is the classic inappropriate older male's offense opinion. David?
And I was just going to say that Lewis Carroll was the Michael Jackson of his day.
Ooh. Oh, dear.
Well, he was exonerated, too.
Well, but, you know, here's the thing. I mean, these kind of accusations or insinuations have never gone away, and yet mm-hmm. we continue to read the books. People continue to respond to them. David, it didn't stop you from a 20-year span of setting this music.
Of course, the reason I set Lewis Carroll, I realized, was very personal. It had nothing to do with his life, about which I knew little when I set the stories. And that was, as a gay man at the time, I identified with Lewis Carroll's suppression. I assumed that he loved little girls, and I assumed that nothing could happen about that. So he must have had all of these feelings that were expressed in this quirky way. So I could identify as a gay man, having gone through all of the early days of gay non-liberation, that I identify with the suppression aspect and having it only come out in art. Mm. So the music I wrote was the only way I could express deep feelings, which are unnamed, of course, in music. And he, too, didn't really express them directly, but subverted it through fantasy and children's stories. So that was, for me, a very personal take on it, regardless of what the reality may be.
The reality, Mara, is even people who make these accusations, I mean, I haven't heard anyone actually ever accuse him of following through on whatever tendencies he may or may not have had. I don't know how people would know to stop at one point and not another, when, as you say, so much material is missing.
Mm-hmm.
But why? I mean, this should have, these even rumors like this would normally be lethal to a book or a play or a song or whatever. And yet, here it is 140 years later, and you know, we have Disney and we have now this new Tim Burton film coming out. How has the story been able to kind of find itself Teflon-coated, I guess?
Well, I would have to say I sympathize a bit with your listener who posted on the web, in the sense that I feel like every time I've tried to teach the Alice books and talk about his personal interest in little girls at the same time, my students have the same reaction. They say, I don't see that. I don't see that she's eroticized in the books, really. I don't see that there's anything problematic about the way other characters really treat her in terms of sex. They don't see it. And, you know, I sort of sympathize with them. I think that's right. I think there's one scene where you see the passion that we were talking about earlier, and that's the scene with the dream rushes, where Alice is reaching out for those flowers that are melting away even as she grasps them. And the language in that scene, she becomes, I think, very eroticized. It's the little hands reach out, and her cheeks are flushed, and her hair is wet. And, you know, there's a very sort of, but that's the one moment, I would say, where I see that. And I feel like the reason the books have survived and thrived, besides the fact that they're so brilliant and ingenious and the dream structure has this wonderful improvisational feel that, you know, it attracts people to rewrite and reproduce and reinvent them, is because I don't think that any kind of personal feeling that he may or may not have had erotically towards little girls, I really don't think it invades the main text of the books. I think we see a tremendous sentimentality about children in those poems that begin and end, you know, the books, and in the endings of the books. But in the middle of them, in the main text, I feel like Alice is a tough, you know, a tough figure. She's interesting. She's been read as a queer figure, picking up on that theme, because she's not interested in motherhood with the pig, you know, the baby that turns into a pig. She's just like, well, I think it's better as a pig. And this was quite radical to have a little girl character in a Victorian book who's just like, yeah, the child's better off as a pig. So, you know, I think that the books themselves are very sharp and not sentimental most of the time, and not, you know, eroticizing Alice and making her into a creepy, erotic figure. And I think that's the answer to your question.
There's some other interesting things I discovered with the annotated Alice, and that is in some of the nonsense poems, the originals for those, Victorian originals, one of them speaks very clearly of a man's love for a girl named Alice. So his nonsense poem is hiding this actual.
Wow.
So there are little puns of around the love aspect that are certainly, and I agree with Mara, that it really does not invade the story. It's my own imagining. And he very carefully kept it out.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing his life, you know, your life is in your art one way or another.
And, you know, is your life in the dramatic switch in your art from the atonal music that preceded the Alice pieces to this lush kind of hyper-romanticism of the Alice works?
Well, for me, the hyper-romanticism was my way of expressing the hidden love, because at the time I wrote it, tonality was a forbidden language, as was Lewis Carroll's love for little girls. So there was a beautiful metaphor in using that for me.
And was it a kind of a metaphor for coming out as a gay man at that point?
Well, I was already out in a way, but it was somehow, yes, it was something forbidden that was being expressed.
What about, is Alice, I mean, at the end of the day, Mara, is Alice a kind of a cipher upon which many people can sort of superimpose many different opinions and impressions?
Absolutely. I think she's a little bit blank as a character in a kind of enticing way, that we don't know all that much about her. It's very easy to identify with her, to make her be one thing or the other. If you think, I mean, she's having an identity crisis, right, in the first one. Who am I? Who am I? And also, if you think about her, she's a lot of things, different things at the same time. So she's polite a lot of the time, but she can also be very rude and aggressive. Sometimes she's nurturing, like she's kind to the White Queen who can't dress herself, but at other times, as we've seen, she's quite, you know, aggressive and non-nurturing. So I do think she's kind of blank. I always think of her as a little bit like Harry Potter, if I dare to say this in that way, as a main character who's just not got that much, you know, of a personality. I'm going to get attacked there on your website. but what I think.
But people have spent 140 years injecting various personalities into
exactly.
Alice and the stories. And so there's this Tim Burton Disney film that's coming out, and 20 years worth of David Del Tredici's music, including the piece in the background called Virtuoso Alice. And we have been talking about music and the books known colloquially as Alice in Wonderland on Soundcheck's Monday series, Music by the Book. My guests have been Mara Gubar from the University of Pittsburgh and David Del Tredici, the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. Mara, David, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, John. A pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up next, Among the Oak and Ash, continue our trip back to another time and place. The duo will share their versions of 19th century Appalachian folk songs. And tomorrow on the show, Steely Dan are embarking on an 8-night run of shows that will certainly reel in the years. We'll debate the group's legacy in our weekly Soundcheck Smackdown tomorrow.